Tina, can you hear me? I could hear you very quietly, Karen. I don't know. It might be my volume.
All right, it sounds like at least I'm on. You can hear me. I'm not having the issues I did last time.
Yep.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Wait.
All right, it's 10 o'clock. Bobby, are you ready? Bobby said there's no audio in the chambers. Can you hear us, Bobby?
Gina, I can hear you. I'll go over and see what's the problem.
Okay, thank you.
Gina, so they can hear you. and no one is online to try to join, so I think we're okay using the anchor location.
Okay.
They're going to troubleshoot while we begin, so I would say you're okay to begin.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. All right. I would like to call the August 15th Pension Committee meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the May 16th, 2024 minutes. Is there any questions or concerns about those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they'll stand approved. Next item is public comment. As Mr. Lawson has mentioned, there is nobody online, and I see nobody here from the public that would like to speak. Next item is the performance reports of the pension and OPEB funds. And again, we have Mr. Pat Wing here with Marquette Associates, and I'm going to turn it over to him. Good morning. You're muted, Pat.
Yeah. 3 years in, 4 years in, still can't figure it out. Well, good morning, Gina, and good morning, everyone else. Please bear with me for a quick second as I share the materials here. Let's see. There we go. Okay, can everybody see my screen?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. So let me start with the performance report here, and I'll maximize this, hopefully a little easier to see on the screen. So with that said, as always, when we're getting into the performance report, I'll skip ahead a little bit here and go to the market environment. Just spend a few minutes talking about the economic and capital markets environment to provide some context for how and why the two funds performed the way they did during the quarter. And as far as what's happened more recently, July was a very different month than what we saw in Q2 from a market leadership perspective, or in other words, which types of stocks did well. And then August, for those of you following along, it's been a volatile month, to say the least, certainly at the beginning, but we've seen a lot of the earlier losses recoup. So one-winded way of saying, I'll try to weave in some commentary as we walk through the report. We also have the July update around what's been happening more recently and our outlook as we close out the calendar year. So with that said, from an economic perspective, you can see, as we note in the top left bullet point here, economic growth did pick up pretty notably in Q2 with real GDP increasing.
Your screen is missing. We can't see it now.
Can't see it now.
No. Okay. Good, but it's gone.
How about now?
No.
No, okay. Let me see this again. Let me try again.
Yep, we can see it again.
Okay. All right, I won't put it in that other version. I'll just leave it like this, but I'll increase it a little bit. As I was saying, economic growth did pick up. In Q2, you can see real GDP, the first estimate was that it increased just a shade under 3%. And if we look at it from a recent historical perspective, you can see the bars here are the quarterly economic growth numbers, whereas the striped bars are economists' estimates as we close out the year. You can see the notable uptick from Q1 into Q2. So what drove that was consumer spending was a little bit better than expected, and then what took place in Q1, but also there was a pickup in inventory investment amongst private firms, and the latter isn't necessarily something that is a persistent driver of overall growth. It tends to oscillate between a contributor and a detractor. So, moving forward for the rest of the year, that's probably one of the reasons economists are expecting a little bit slower growth, because inventories again rose quite dramatically, and therefore in the back half of the year, we might get a little bit of payback to that huge build in inventories. Now, as far as looking ahead a little bit, one of the key things that we're focusing on and many market participants and economists are focusing on is the labor market, and specifically because, obviously have a big impact on the outlook for the consumer, given income growth and job growth, and secondly, a big impact on what the Federal Reserve may or may not do from a rate perspective here as we close out the year. So we did note in this, these data were put together before the July report, which I'll speak to shortly, that the labor market did begin to soften or show signs of softening. You can see the unemployment rate at the end of June was 4.1%, notably above its 12-month low of 3.5%. And looking forward, there were signs that that was likely going to continue to tick upward. So if we look at the top right chart here, we're just showing small business hiring plans versus the unemployment rate. So the darker line is small business hiring plans, and it's on an inverted scale here to the left, meaning that when the line is going up, hiring plans are weakening and vice versa. And you can see the strong relationship with the unemployment rate here in gray over time. But more recently, you can see a notable weakening in those hiring plans. So in turn, using it as somewhat of a leading indicator, you know, we argued it's likely that the unemployment rate would continue to tick up. Now, that said, the July report that we saw come out a couple of weeks ago was notably weaker than a lot had been expecting. You know, job growth was still firmly positive, but lower than expectations. And we saw the unemployment rate tick up a couple of tenths to 4.3. Now, even though we're expecting the unemployment rate to tick up, we think that that report was a little bit of an anomaly due to Hurricane Beryl that was kind of running through Texas and the southern U.S. at the time that the BLS was collecting information for the survey. So we saw a couple of things like a very low response rate to the survey. We saw a lot of people report as temporarily detached from employment around the time. So in other words, again, we expect things to soften, but in the next report in August, which will be released right after Labor Day, there's probably going to be somewhat of a payback on the positive sense where, again, the survey response rate ticks up and maybe some of those people who are temporarily detached from employment are able to regain their jobs for the month. But still, over the next few quarters, it seems pretty likely that the trend is going to be a continued soft labor market, which in turn likely has implications, number one, for consumer spending, but also what the Federal Reserve may do. So prior to that report, you can see down below here, the markets were seeing or pricing in 3 rate cuts this year from the Fed. Immediately subsequent to that report, it was pricing in 5 cuts from the Fed, and there were only 3 meetings left after the report, meaning that at 2 of the 3 meetings, they were pricing in half a percentage point cut. Since then, the data have come in a little better than expected from a labor market perspective, and weekly jobless killings have been pretty good. And even this morning, there was a retail sales report that came in fairly strong. So the market's backed off that a little bit, and now it's pricing in about a 75% chance of a 25 basis point cut in September, and somewhere between 3 and 4 cuts by the end of the year. We think 3 is probably the number, absent some huge shock, again, because that labor market report was probably overstating the weakness in the market due to the hurricane. Now, that said, if we take a look at what happened in markets during the quarter, it was certainly much more muted than we saw in Q1 and certainly in Q4 last year. We did have broadly positive returns, just again, more muted than more recently. So U.S. equities were up a little north of 3%. You can see here, international developed equities, so places like Europe, Japan, Australia, was actually slightly negative. And then emerging markets led the way for the first time in a while. They were up 5%. As far as U.S. bonds are concerned, you can see they're basically flat for the quarter. So what that tells us is that interest rates did increase slightly during the quarter, putting downward pressure on bond prices. But then the income accrued and paid out for bonds during the quarter basically offset that price pressure, leaving things more or less flat. Now, as we'll see here in a few minutes, the fixed income within the bonds has less interest rate exposure or less interest rate risk than the broad investment grade universe as depicted here, meaning that when rates ticked up a little bit during the quarter, the bond prices within the funds weren't as susceptible to those rate changes. So the fixed income within the funds actually did a lot better by about a half a percentage point than what we're showing here. As far as the other asset classes in the funds, you see bank loans here up around 2% during the quarter, continuing to post pretty steady gains since they were added to the funds about a year ago, up around 11% over that time. And as we'll see here shortly and have a more detailed discussion later on, real estate remains under pressure, although the returns have been becoming less bad. But infrastructure continues to post pretty steady returns and was up north of 2% during the quarter. Now, a couple other quick comments I want to make, provide a little bit of context before we get into the results, particularly from an equity market perspective, is it was a pretty bifurcated market during the quarter, meaning that there were a handful of stocks that did very well, whereas most of the market was actually under a little bit of pressure. And I can illustrate that with a couple of charts here, starting with the sector returns. So here we're showing the 11 economic sectors within the broad U.S. equity market. And these lighter bars are the Q2 returns. So you can see here that 7 of the 11 sectors were actually negative. And, you know, when you think about that versus my comment a minute ago, how the market was up 3%, it almost seems counterintuitive. But the reason why the market was up so much is that the largest sectors, which are comprised by the largest stocks, did quite well. So up top, you can see communication services up just a shade under double digits. That sector is dominated by names like Meta, which is the old Facebook, and Alphabet, the parent company of Google. And then information technology as well, up north of 12%, where you'll find names like Apple, Microsoft, and a lot of the semiconductor makers like NVIDIA, Broadcom, that have been dominating the market returns more recently as the market becomes, you know, borderline, I'll say, obsessed with the AI narrative. That's also depicted, I think, nicely at the top chart on the next page, and I'll speak to a second around why this is important. Up top, you can see what we're showing here is the quarterly performance of the S&P 500, which is a market cap weighted benchmark, meaning the larger the company, the greater the weighting it has in the index, versus an S&P 500 equal weighted index, meaning that each individual company has an equal weight, so company size does not matter. So the green line over time is just showing the relative quarterly performance. So the lines above zero, it means the S&P 500 outperforms and vice versa. And here's the number for Q2, almost 7 percentage points of outperformance for the market cap weighted benchmark, which was the second highest level of outperformance going back some 20 years, just shy of what we saw coming out of COVID. So why that's important is generally that's a tough environment for equity managers, when the largest stocks do the best, because typically managers won't hold the largest stocks in proportion to their weighting in the benchmark, because then they'll look like the benchmark and then you can't outperform, essentially net of fees if you look like the benchmark. So over time, that's a structural headwind when the largest stocks do the best, and certainly vice versa. And we saw the other outcome in July. Again, it was a very different market, which I'll illustrate when we get to the update in a little bit. One of the reasons why these largest stocks have been doing so well really comes down to how well their businesses have been performing over the past couple of years. So this chart below illustrates that a bit, where we're showing the annual earnings growth for the previous calendar year, the estimate for this year, and then the next couple of years for 5 of the largest stocks in the market. You see their tickers down here versus the median company in the S&P. So just look at 2023, for instance. There was a 54 percentage point difference in annual earnings growth, which is set to narrow this year, but still be very wide, and then set to narrow in the coming years. But so there is certainly a foundation for some of the outperformance by these stocks. But what's been happening more recently is that investors tend to extrapolate these things are very, very positive recent outcomes into the future, and then bid up the share prices of these stocks and increase their valuation such that it increases the bar or the expectation so high that then it becomes hard for these companies to meet or even exceed those expectations. So we saw the first signs of that really at the sort of latter half of July, when a lot of these companies reported their earnings, where earnings were still pretty strong. But since expectations had gotten so high and valuations had increased so much, a lot of their stocks came under pressure, not just towards the end of July, but also in early August when the market was experiencing some volatility. So again, this is sort of the foundation for why they did more recently. But one of the reasons that we're underweight these names is we think expectations have gotten so far ahead of themselves that even though these companies will continue to grow at a pretty good clip, that they're not going to be able to surpass the bar that investors have sort of set for them. And we did see some early signs of that again in July and in early August when the market was experiencing some weakness. So with that said, let's get into the results with that context. And we'll start with the pension here. And I'll just skip the observations. We'll discuss that as we work through the pages. But as far as the results, just from a market value perspective, you can see we began the quarter about $163.8 million. Some cash flows that netted out to about negative $1.89 million with the reimbursement taking place before the end of the fiscal year. But that was more than offset by the net investment change of about $2.58 million. So all told, the pension grew by about $687,000. You can see the returns in the middle of the page, and we'll tackle these in more detail in just a minute when we get to the peer perspective. But for the quarter, the pension returned 1.6%. It was about 30 basis points behind the policy index, pretty much for the equity dynamic reasons I spoke to earlier around the larger companies doing the best. And again, I'll illustrate that with the data here shortly. But most importantly here, the one-year number coming in to just a shade under 13%. So remember, this is the fiscal year number. It's a little more than 6 percentage points above the actuarial assumed rate of return. So all else equal, which it never is, but all else equal, that should mean some positive impact to the fund's health. The funded ratios given this year was greater than what they were assuming, recouping some of the actuarial losses that we saw in fiscal year 2022, when both stocks and fixed income were under a decent amount of pressure. So with that said, just taking a look at some of the changes during the quarter, and then we'll dig into the returns a little bit more deeply. As I've talked about for our meetings earlier this year, as the market continued to sort of grind higher, we've been taking opportunities to rebalance, right, to trim exposure, mostly because, again, you know, our expectations were that eventually we would see some volatility in this market, which we saw in July and early August, but also for expectations that the reimbursements were coming at the end of June. So we did trim equities to the tune of about $450,000. You can see cumulatively here. We continue to get money back from Clarion, the real estate manager, via redemptions and income. And at the beginning of the quarter, we had that contribution going to JP Morgan. So we'll talk more about it later on, but recall there's about a 5% target to each of those asset classes a couple years ago, which was shifted from 5.5 to 3.7 for real estate and infrastructure respectively. And we're slowly moving to those as we get redemptions back and income being paid back from real estate. So with that said, let's look at the returns in a high level, and then we'll dig into the underlying funds. So this page is the peer page. You can see up top, again, a lot of other public defined benefit funds within the universe, and we can just compare and contrast how the pension is doing on a relative basis, on an anonymized basis, to other public defined benefit funds out there. You can see the universe size for each respective time period down here where it says number of portfolios, so it kind of ranges from a little more than 300 for the longer period to more recently, a little more than 400. But that takeaway is, you know, it's a very broad, robust sample size to draw some conclusions. And then as far as the fund and the policy index, you can see down here signified by the circle and the X. And as we work our way from left to right, you can see for the quarter, even though the fund was behind the policy index slightly, it was still good for top 18%. Remember, lower numbers are better in this exercise, and the numbers in parentheses are the rankings. So in other words, the fund did better than 82% of the 417 funds within this universe. So as you work from left to right, you pretty much see a consistent dynamic here from the quarter to the 5 years, kind of oscillating between that top decile, top quartile across most periods. 10-year numbers not quite as well. Remember, the back half or years kind of 6 to 10, we still had a lot of that money with the state, which wasn't performing quite as well as things have done more recently, as we got that money back and, you know, moved it into more traditional asset classes, and then some additional diversification via infrastructure and via bank loans more recently. I think the broad takeaway here is pretty evident that the fund's doing fairly well on a relative basis to peers, you know, regardless of whether we're looking at short, intermediate, or long-term horizons. And then just a couple quick comments on some of the underlying funds here, and then we can touch on the OPEP briefly, and as always, happy to answer questions and comments. So the returns up top, again, you can see that for the total fund, they're the same data that I just walked through on the peer page. But then again, anytime you see a darker line where it says composite, it's just a weighted average of the underlying funds. So total equity being US, global, non-US equity, was about 60 basis points behind the benchmark there. So given that it comprised about 60% of the total fund, you know, 60% of 60 basis points is basically the difference here, right? So in other words, the underperformance within equities drove this, per my comments earlier, of the largest stocks driving the bulk of the gains. And you can see that dynamic within US, which was about 40 basis points behind the benchmark. So even though we have a huge slug of the U.S. equities within a large cap passive index for the S&P 500 index fund, which was up 4.3%, having some funds in small and mid-cap stocks here below, which where you can see are in the red, was the detractor, right? And you can see the illustration of my comments earlier around how difficult it was for managers with this number here, basically the ranking of the index in the top quartile for the quarter. So in other words, the index did better than 72% of managers for the quarter because those larger stocks outperformed by that dramatic margin, as I showed earlier about the cap-weighted benchmark versus its equal-weighted counterpart. Similar dynamics were playing out in the global equity space. Again, three managers here, and even though two of three, Dodge & Cox and MFS, were actually ahead of their respective benchmarks, these guys are sort of structurally underweight those largest names as well. So that was the headwind going on with global equities. On the flip side, on the next page, you can see non-US equities were about a half a point ahead during the quarter, mostly coming from emerging markets. So we have a slight overweight to emerging markets within non-US equities because we believe they're relatively cheap compared to their international developed counterparts. So having a little bit more money in the best performing equity region really drove the outperformance during the quarter. Then as far as real estate's concerned, you can see here, and we'll talk more about this in a couple minutes, Clarion was down about 2% during the quarter. The dynamics around real estate continue to be challenged for all the reasons we've talked about in the past. I won't belabor them here. We'll talk a little bit more about them later on. But as far as Clarion itself, it continues not to sort of pump money into its office properties and slowly mark them down, but it's selling the properties. So it's realizing the losses to reposition the portfolio. So right now they only have about 10% in office after selling five or six properties over the past 6 to 9 months, whereas the broader real estate market still has about an 18 to 20% weighting to office. So in other words, they've taken a lot of short-term pain by just getting out, repositioning the portfolio, whereas a lot of other managers in the space are slowly sort of taking their medicine, kind of drip by drip, hoping that the market sort of reasserts itself, where Clarion is saying, we're not pumping more money into these properties, we're just gonna sell, take our medicine and move on. And the disposition of two office properties really drove that during the quarter. But we can talk more about that in a couple of minutes. Now, on the flip side, from an infrastructure perspective, you can see JP Morgan here up 2.3%. So more than offsetting the Clarion underperformance there, not just from a return perspective, but also that weighting perspective as we get closer to the 3 to 7 here that's currently in place. As far as some other quick comments here, you can see bank loans, Aristotle, the manager we're using there, was a little bit behind the benchmark during the quarter by about 30 basis points. Year-to-date, one-year numbers pretty strong in line to slightly ahead. And then fixed income, as I talked about earlier, a different benchmark than I showed, which was half a percentage points ahead of that 0.1 for the broad investment grade universe. And then in aggregate here with Wilmington Trust and the other managers being incrementally ahead of the fixed income benchmark. So with that said, I'll just give some quick highlights to the OPEB. We won't go through it in great detail because the investments mirror themselves, just to give you a high level take on what happened. So for the second quarter, you could see the beginning market value for the OPEB was $66.35 million. Again, some cash flows going on. We saw a net flow of about $257,000. That was more than offset by the net investment change, just over $1 million. So all told, the OPEB grew by just a shade under $800,000 during the quarter. The returns in the middle of the page here, again, I won't belabor this, they're the same in the quarter, year-to-date, 1 year as the pension. We'll talk a little bit more about them when we get to them from a peer perspective. And then as far as the changes made during the month, obviously the size of the changes are a little bit lower than the pension due to the smaller size of the OPEB, but in spirit, they mimic each other. Namely, trimming equities as the market continued to run up in Q2, you see here to the tune of about $150,000, getting money back from Clarion via redemptions and income, the contribution to JP Morgan, and then obviously funding the reimbursement down here from the money market fund. And then finally, again, just from a quick look on the peer perspective, same analysis we spoke to for the pension, and pretty much the same results. However, the only key difference really being in the 10-year, you know, not having the OPEB in the state a while back, you can see a little bit of a better number for the OPEB here compared to the pension, but more recently, kind of again, oscillating between that top decile, top quartile, so much like the pension, performing pretty well relative to the peer group. So before I jump into the July update and talk a little bit about our outlook as we close out the year, are there any questions or comments from the committee around Q2?
We're good, thanks.
You're good? Okay. Thanks, Gina. I can't see anybody, so I appreciate that. Okay. So just quickly for July, as I mentioned earlier, it's a very different environment in July, notably that those larger stocks that had done so well in Q2 came under a little bit of pressure. Recall that I mentioned how they were releasing those earnings reports in later July and, you know, a lot of it not able to meet the, you know, really high bar of expectations that investors had placed on them, given the recent run and valuations, which our opinion had become stretched. So even though equities were more broadly positive, it was a shift in leadership. So I'll signify or illustrate that in a second, but quarter to date, the fund up just a shade under 2%, about 20 basis points ahead of that policy index, largely due to the equity component. So that drove slight underperformance in Q2. In turn, in July, it drove the outperformance. Again, why? Because the stocks that underperformed in Q2 did a heck of a lot better in July. And you can see that by the S&P 500 index only up 1.2% compared to the broad market that was up a shade under 2. So having those allocations to small and mid-cap stocks down here, which were a headwind in Q2, was a tailwind in July. The similar story for global equities. Again, these managers were structurally underweight those larger names. So when those larger names underperformed, that was helpful on a relative basis. Non-US equities, not too much to speak of, you know, kind of broadly in line with the benchmark there. As far as real estate's concerned, we get these numbers on a quarterly basis. However, some of the managers in the universe do report monthly, and the two that we've seen have actually posted slightly positive results in July, we think largely due to the decline in interest rates that we saw in July. Remember, real estate is an inherently sort of leveraged asset class, right? If you think about your home and the mortgage you might have on your home, you know, the loan there is essentially leveraged in the investment in your home. Similar story for this asset class. So when the cost of debt or perhaps refinancing comes down, that is typically a tailwind. So we'll see how the numbers play out for the current quarter. But if rates have come down pretty dramatically, if they stay relatively stable here over the next few months, we could possibly see maybe a flat or even slightly positive return for real estate for the first time in a while here in Q3. Infrastructure, similar story. We get the numbers on a quarterly basis, so nothing to report yet there. Bank loans, fixed income, broadly in line with their respective benchmarks. And then for the OPEB, again, I won't belabor the comments I just made. All the underlying investments mirror each other for the pension, so the results at the headline level here are the same. So as we think about what's happened more recently and through the rest of the year, you know, we did see a decent downdraft in the beginning of August. The market actually peaked kind of in mid-July, and there was kind of a slow grind lower until we saw some volatility in early August on the back of that poor employment report I talked about earlier in the meeting and some technical factors emanating out of Japan that I won't bore you with. Markets have recovered much of that lost ground. I would estimate that, you know, through yesterday, the OPEB and the pension are probably down around 0.5% for the month. So this 1.9, as we sit here this morning, is probably closer to 1.4, 1.5. So still broadly positive despite the early August weakness. Now, as we close out the rest of the year, you know, markets admittedly have surprised us with their strength. But if we take a look at what history tells us a little bit for, you know, the typical path during an election year. Election years are usually broadly positive, not as good as year three of the presidential cycle, which was last year. But what's interesting is that September and October are usually the worst months during the year. And they're not, you know, horrible, but they're just not as good as the rest of the months. And big believers that is just a reflection of uncertainty around how things are going to play out, right? As the election is tight from a polling perspective, not knowing what is going to happen. Markets don't particularly like uncertainty. Now, once the election's over and the November, December, things usually calm down and markets grind a little higher. But we do think that September and October period, given its historical weakness, is, you know, a good guide to think about things over the next couple months. So long-winded explanation of saying if the market continues to grind higher as we close out August, we're likely going to take that as an opportunity to rebalance like we've done through much of the year in anticipation of maybe some volatility in the coming months as we head up to the early November election. So with all that said, I will pause once more, see if there are any questions or comments before we hit our last deck with the real estate discussion.
Pat, yes. You mentioned earlier about the big names really doing well this year. Do you guys have an outlook as far as whether that may rotate into some other sectors that you've shown that haven't done so well?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
As far as you mentioned the big name, the big companies that have done well.
Yes.
Do you see where we may rotate some of the other sectors that haven't performed?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it really comes down to the economic outlook. So if we continue to see a broadly, you know, market that's going to continue to grind higher, and the Fed is going to lower rates at the same time, that's going to alleviate some of the pressure on those smaller companies that have a lot of interest rate exposure. And in that environment, we'll see a rotation. If economic weakness continues to play out a little bit here, then and we see a bigger drawdown in markets, then I would expect, you know, those types of companies to do better than their larger counterparts. Because of their much cheaper valuations, but I would expect them probably to drop in unison with the larger ones. So kind of a long-winded way of saying, you know, we expect them to do well on a relative basis. These areas that did well in July, but not so much in Q2 and for much of the past year. But if the market comes under pressure, we don't think they're going to be immune to it, that they'll just drop less than those larger companies that have those pretty extended valuations.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Okay, should we jump in the real estate discussion, Gina?
Yes, please.
Okay. So I will maximize this as well. And just as a quick rehash, and I spoke a little bit about this earlier. Recall that real estate was approved and implemented several years ago. Infrastructure followed. We were at 5.5, and then I think it was, you know, maybe around the November meeting in 22, decided to shift that allocation to 3% and 7% respectively. So given our conversations this year and given Gina's question at the last meeting, thought it might be appropriate just to give you a broader update on where real estate fundamentals stand, sort of a base case outlook for the asset class itself, and if the committee wishes to just move on and exit the asset class, you know, to where should that those monies flow. So with that said, you can see this page, you know, it's just a reprint of the performance I showed earlier. You know, the one thing I didn't note earlier, which is relevant, doesn't necessarily feel like it, but is that, you know, real estate's up slightly positive since it's been put in both funds at 1.7%, and it was sourced from fixed income at the time, which is actually up a little less than 1% on an annualized basis. So, and that I totally get it. It certainly doesn't feel like it's been helpful to either fund, but in aggregate since inception, it actually has been ever so slightly positive, because from where we took the money has actually only had a return about half of real estate itself. As far as the fundamentals, just more broadly, we've seen valuations, as you all know, as we've talked about repeatedly, come down fairly dramatically, really driven by office. So office is down around 37% since the start of the pandemic. You can see that in the darker blue line here. The other sectors, major sectors within real estate, obviously have not been immune to that, but whether it be industrial or multifamily, which is another name for apartment, or even retail. Retail's actually, you know, shockingly been under the least amount of pressure, but as we all know, it's down, way down from its earlier peak pre-COVID, given the Amazon effect, if you will, that was beginning to pressure those valuations, you know, we'll call it 6 or 7 years ago. So valuations have certainly come under pressure, trying to, you know, signify or illustrate, you know, just how much more recently, but why that's been the case. Obviously, vacancy rates have ticked up really, again, across the board here. You can, again, see office in this darker blue, right? Pandemic right around here, vacancy rates tick up rather notably. Whereas in other sectors, again, I've seen slight upticks more recently, and there's retail again. So you can see that as the market digests new supply. So every year, you know, new real estate development projects are put into place, but it takes years for those properties to come online, right? Come into the market, start to rent out space to, you know, whether it be companies for industrial or office or families for apartment buildings. But those properties come online, say, in year X or say this year, but the development plans were put into place in, say, year X minus five, maybe 5 years ago. So there's still new supply coming onto the market, which is also pressuring valuations to some degree. Now, that said, the new supply started, say, a year or two ago is extremely limited, which, say, in 3, 4, 5 years should be helpful to the market, right? You're not digesting that new supply. If you just think about price from a supply-demand perspective, the less supply of something you have, the greater its price should be. So the market's still digesting some pre-COVID development coming onto the market, but that is slowing, and in the coming year should slow and maybe be helpful to some degree. A big concern around real estate now, and I'm sure I'm not again telling you anything you don't already know, just trying to put a number on some things, is that there's a lot of maturities coming due. Now, generally, these are staggered. As you can see in the table here, it's broken down by sector, which is, you know, makes sense, right? If you're a real estate manager, you don't have everything come due in the same year, because then you're putting a lot of risk on, you know, what the economic environment's going to look like, what the supply demand dynamics are going to look like, where rates are going to be when you have to refinance these loans. But there is certainly a lot more maturities coming due this year and next year than, say, in 26 and 27. And the keys around this is really, you know, how are real estate firms going to work with lenders in refinancing these properties? You know, a lot of lenders, for obvious reasons, are not going to, you know, supply as much loans or leverage for the owners of these properties, right? They're going to want the owners to put in more equity to lessen the risk to lenders, where in turn, the owners might not want to do that, say, put more equity into an office space where the uncertainty is just so high, given the work from home environment and the post-COVID environment. So this is a big uncertainty, right? As these maturities come due, to what extent are the lenders and the borrowers able to work out terms in order to, say, not flood the market? Because, you know, you can have an environment where the borrowers are just saying, you know, handing the keys back to the lender, saying, you know what, you're asking for too much. We can't come to an agreement. Here are the keys. Take the building back. Just as, like, if you foreclosed on your home, right, the bank would secure your home because your mortgage is secured by your home, same type of environment. You know, banks don't want that, right? So they are working with lenders to some degree, but we are hearing anecdotes of some cases where the borrowers are just saying, take the keys back to the banks, and then, you know, basically it goes into foreclosure, goes into an auction, and in that sort of environment, whatever it sells at is a comparable price for other properties and puts downward pressure on prices. So there's a lot of uncertainty around how this is going to play out. The one positive, you know, it's not all negative. There is a slight positive, is that, you know, despite this tough environment in recent years, you see overall NOI growth remains positive. So NOI is just net operating income. So it's basically your revenue for your properties that you own, less your expenses. Okay, so it's still remained broadly positive more recently, even though you can see the retail issue coming out of the pandemic and some other issues in multifamily. Even office has been generally above the flat line, right? So it's not that these guys aren't making money or have operating income on these properties. It's the valuations that have driven the contraction in the returns that we've seen more recently. So obviously the fundamentals leave a little bit to be desired, to say the least. The uncertainty is pretty wide around how this is going to play out. So let's talk about, you know, return expectations for real estate and some other asset classes here before we wrap up. So these are expected returns by property type, sourced from PREA, the Pension Real Estate Association. It's a pretty broad survey that's done once a year around, you know, what are return expectations over the next 5 years, not just for real estate as a whole, but also the individual sectors. So this would be the real estate as a whole, and you can see the total return here, the expectations a little north of 5, but it's all driven by income, right? Appreciation is pretty much negligible. And that's pretty much the story as you work your way from left to right here, as far as the total returns being fairly reasonable. And in most sectors, obviously not so much for office, because the expectation is it's going to continue to remain under a decent amount of pressure in the coming years. So if we think about, you know, a negative 4% roughly annualized depreciation over the next 5 years, you know, if we backdoor that and put it in cumulative terms, it's not quite 20%. That's not how the numbers work out exactly, but we could call it, say, 18 to 19% in remaining depreciation for that sector, which in turn is going to drag down a lot of the overall market, because it still comprises about 20% of the universe. Now, again, this is a base case from a survey. Obviously, these people are real estate investors, so they're very in tune with what's going on in the market. But I think when you think about the potential outcomes and a base case versus the range of outcomes, right, the distribution of potential outcomes, this is probably be negatively skewed, meaning that if you think about a normal distribution and a bell curve, and I'm trying to do that with my cursor here, the right tail or the positive outcomes are probably pretty truncated, or, you know, pretty close to not terribly above this 5%, whereas the left side of the tail is probably pretty skewed to the left, meaning that they're, given the uncertainty around the supply, the loans, what's going to happen in the dynamics between the borrowers and the banks being the lenders, that the potential for negative outcomes certainly outweighs the potential for positive outcomes. So in other words, again, there's a lot of uncertainty around this base case. Whereas if we think about other asset classes to where the money could possibly go, could possibly be fixed income, right? Come full circle, pretty much, you know, we source from fixed income, you know, 5-6 years ago, whenever it was, when yields were extremely low, as evidenced by this blue line here, but now yields are much higher. So when we think about a certainty perspective, I talked about a lot of the uncertainty around the potential outcome for real estate. The one good thing about fixed income, there are actually two good things. Number one, yields are much higher today. They're still, you know, not through the roof, but they're multiples of where they were a few years ago. But the certainty is much greater, right? The potential outcomes are much narrower, because returns, as evidenced in this orange line, follow yields. So in other words, you have a very high beginning yield back in the late 70s, early 80s. Subsequent to that, 5 years later, you have very high returns. And that's why this orange line mimics this blue line quite closely. That's why returns have been pretty bad more recently, because yields were extremely low, but now they're much higher at about 4.3%. So what's a reasonable estimate over the next 5 years? Well, it's about 4.3%. And then finally, the other quick thing here on bank loans before we wrap this up and put it all together, just wanted to show you that even despite the 11% return from bank loans over the past year, the yields are still up in the 9% range. You can see it boxed it up here about in the 9% range, versus a long-term average of around 7.5. So as we talked about when we did the education for the asset class, you know, it's essentially a base rate, meaning, you know, more or less where the Fed funds rate is, plus a spread. So if the Fed does start to cut rates, this yield will come down in sympathy with that, but still be yielding, you know, much more than, say, core fixed income in an environment where Fed cuts rates by, you know, 2-2.5 percentage points. In turn, this might go to, you know, 6.5-7. So still yielding a decent amount currently, and will still yield a decent amount if the Fed does cut rates, say, again, by 2-2.5 percentage points in the coming years. So when we put these pieces together, what we just wanted to outline quickly is the current targets, the base case outlook, and some options for the committee to consider here. So what we're showing in the first column is the current policy targets for all the respective asset classes listed here to the left. So this is the current in the IPS. You can see our base case outcome over the next 10 years for this mix is just a shade under 7%, which is in line with the assumed rate of return. And then the risk profile here, the projected volatility, and then a risk-adjusted return where we're just dividing the return by the risk. So think about it as how much return are we generating per unit of risk. Now, if the committee wishes to you know, just move on from real estate here, given the uncertainty, we think two potential options are reasonable to consider. Number one, just taking real estate down to 3, moving that all into fixed income. As I showed earlier, the base case outlook for real estate is a little north of 5. A lot of uncertainty for fixed. It's probably more in that 4.3, 4.5 range. So from a base case perspective, it would be a little bit of a lower return, but you have more certainty around what that return would be, right? Higher certainty that you will get around that assumed rate of return. So you do see a slight downtick in the base case, but you're still in line with it and a little bit better of a volatility or risk projection. Or finally, again, removing real estate, having a couple percentage points go into fixed income and maybe an additional percentage points in the bank loan, which would essentially leave you with the same base case outcome as you have now. But in all three of these cases, again, the base case is, you know, in line or slightly above the assumed rate of return, which is the most important thing. So with all that said, I will pause there to see if there are any questions or comments around the overview or, you know, reasonable changes here from A or B that we put forth for the committee to consider.
Does anybody have any comments on the recommendations of getting out of real estate? Particularly, I'd like to hear from Ms. Ryan or Mr. Rogers.
Okay, thanks. This is Kit. Good morning. Do we have Pat's recommendation on which avenue he would prefer to see us go? Or are we, they're agnostic to the recommendations and they just want us to kind of vote as a committee?
So let me jump in there, Gina. So I think, you know, obviously exiting real estate makes sense at this point. You know, it was it's been obviously painful recently. In aggregate, as I mentioned, it's been helpful, if you can believe it, since where we sourced the money from. But now that fixed income is yielding higher, I think, you know, option A is perfectly reasonable. You know, bank loans have done well more recently. I think the return outlook would obviously come down a little bit if the Fed does cut rates. But so A is a little bit more conservative than B. It still gets you to where you need to be. So if the committee is looking for a recommendation from me, I think A is the cleanest and simplest option to move forward with, and that would be it.
Okay. I agree with that. I am worried a little bit about bank loans should the Fed cut, especially if they cut aggressively. But I don't know. I mean, how quickly could you move if we looked at option B and to get our allocation lower on bank loans should they be affected negatively by the Fed cutting rates?
Well, in B, the bank loans would go up. So just think about this, you know, these are from a target perspective. Obviously we still have ranges, which I'm not showing on the page. So, you know, even if we increase the target to 4, it doesn't necessarily mean we would increase the allocation to 4, because we would agree with you, the Fed is likely to cut rates in that environment and the outlook would worsen. You know, we still think it's a decent asset class, but that 8% I showed earlier probably go to 6 to 6.5. So again, it's just a target. It's not saying we're going to do this, you know, tomorrow if you approve it and the council approve it. It's just a long-term target. So we probably remain underweight that 4% if you move to that, just like we're underweight the 3% as we sit here this morning.
Okay. I'm probably inclined to move more towards option B if you're not going to do the full allocation and just have it out there as a target, because that gives us some flexibility down the road in case we need it.
That's a good point. Yep.
Yeah,
Yeah, I would agree with the opportunity in fixed income if we can lower the real estate and get, like you said, pretty much the same result with a little bit less risk, then I would agree that's the thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I always like the conservative approach, so I was leaning towards option A. But I agree, that 1% does give you some flexibility. So I can definitely lean to option B and add that extra percent to the bank loans. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have any comments on the recommendation? Okay, hearing none. Let me, I'm crafting the motion. Right now, okay, so the motion is being moved that the pension committee makes a recommendation to Sussex County Council to adjust the investment policy statements for both the pension and OPEB funds to increase fixed income by 2% and increase bank loans by 1% and decrease real estate by 3%. Does anyone want to make that motion?
I'll make that motion.
Thank you. Ms. Bryan makes the motion. Do I have a second?
I'll make the motion.
Thank you. I have a second by Mr. Rogers, and we'll take a vote. Ms. Brewington?
Yes.
Ms. Griffith?
Yes.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Ms. Roth?
Yes.
Ms. Ryan?
Yes.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
I vote yes. The motion carries. All right. Mr. Wing, do you have anything else?
That's it for me today. I appreciate everybody's patience and time this morning. As I always let Gina know, when I see you in person in November and the actuaries there, I promise to keep it brief. I let them, let them be the headliner, but I appreciate your time this morning. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
That does remind me, our meeting in November will be in person. We will have the actuaries here. So unless anybody has any additional business, can I have a motion to adjourn?
I'll make that motion, Gina.
Okay, a motion and a second.
Second.
And a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.
You too.